from deep inside your radio.
Ladies and gentlemen, when I spoke last week of the fleeting nature, the inherently fleeting nature, the inherently shabby and ramshackle nature of unequivocal political statements like we'll never negotiate with terrorists or anybody who harbors a terrorist is as bad as a terrorist, little did I realize how close to horizontal the House of Cards actually is. The extent of the deterioration in U.S.-Saudi relations was exposed for the first time yesterday, according to the British newspaper The Guardian, when Washington accused Riyadh, Saudi capital, of working to undermine the Iraqi government. The Bush administration warned Saudi Arabia to stop undermining Prime Minister al-Maliki. Bush administration is telling the Saudis, so far without success, that establishing a stable government in Iraq is in their interest, and they stand to suffer if it collapses. Relations have been strained since King Abdullah unexpectedly criticized the U.S., describing the Iraqi invasion as a, quote, illegal foreign occupation. Our friends the Saudis, ladies and gentlemen. The British government shares many of the U.S.'s concerns, but is reluctant to go public. Zalmay Khalilzad, recently the U.S. ambassador to Baghdad before he got shunted off to the U.N., protested to the Saudis over fake documents distributed in Baghdad, which claimed Maliki was an Iranian agent. And we're also, the administration is also unhappy about the Saudis failing to stem the flow of Saudi jihadists across its border to fight in Iraq, often as suicide bombers. It's the Saudis, ladies and gentlemen. But they got a lot of oil. In fact, according to the Wall Street Journal, a year after the 9/11 attacks, U.S. authorities began to lament the lack of Saudi action in tracking down terrorists' financial infrastructure. It was way back in 2002. A CIA report of that year said the Saudi government, quote, has made little independent effort to uncover terrorist financiers, investigate individual donors, and tighten the regulation of Islamic charities, largely because of, quote, domestic political considerations. Isn't that the same excuse used by President Musharraf for not cracking down harder on the Taliban? Yes, it is. The CIA report advised against a noisy confrontation. Quote, a key factor for continued successful counterterrorism initiatives with the Saudis will be to ensure their cooperation with the United States is handled as discreetly and kept as much as possible out of the public eye. Unquote. So what does it mean when we go against them publicly? You tell me, Department. Similarly, The Washington Post reports the United States military in Iraq is expanding its efforts to recruit and fund armed Sunni residents as local irregular protection forces, authorizing commanders to pay the fighters with U.S. emergency funds, reward payments, and other monies. I like the sound of that. Can you send my compensation, please, in other monies? I hope that's not what's in the Simpsons movie deal, other monies. The initiative to pay Sunnis and arm them, perhaps, to be our friends is a temporary departure from the established U.S. policy of building formerly trained security forces under the control of the Iraqi government. It also provokes fears within that government, led by Shiites, that the new Sunni groups will use their arms against it. Can you say civil war? The goal is to put the new irregular forces in place quickly, hiring them on contracts and providing them with uniforms without waiting for access to lengthy police and army training programs. That's right. We've given up on training. Just here's a uniform, here's a gun, and here's other monies. In the long term, the goal is to incorporate the units into the Iraqi security forces, to which we can only say good luck, and to which Prime Minister Maliki says, I'm not so sure about that. I criticize this program. Not the radio program. The program to fund Sunni armed irregulars yesterday. But we proceed. nonetheless, because, you know, we never negotiate with the buried lead of the week, though, has to come from a story in the Washington Post about the Musharraf government in Pakistan. Musharraf is now so desperate, he's actually talking to Benazir Bhutto, the last civilian prime minister whom he had arranged to have corruption charges brought against to keep her out of the country. Now he's saying, won't you come into my government, please? Anyway, there's a story about Pakistan and its on-again, off-again crackdown on al-Qaeda and Taliban in that pesky northwest province. James R. Clapper, the Pentagon's top intelligence official, says the Musharraf government is not doing, quote, 100% of everything we might like, unquote. But he says, quote, I think they're doing what they can given the constraints, those pesky domestic political considerations. But here's the buried lead, ladies and gentlemen, deep in the story, deep near the bottom, the real news. New efforts by Pakistan to rout al-Qaeda out of its haven, quote, are only in the first week or so of implementation, unquote, Clapper said. Welcome aboard. Hello, welcome to the show.
Still shines. Thank God.
From the edge of America, from the home of the homeless, I'm Harry Shearer, welcoming you to this edition of Le Show. I'm not welcoming you to any other edition of Le Show ever broadcast. Let me make that right clear right now. Ladies and gentlemen, it was a tragic and bizarre juxtaposition this week when on Friday two news helicopters collided, killing two people aboard each craft, only days after half the population of the city of Santa Monica was awakened at about 4 in the morning by at least three news choppers hovering over the community in that quiet way they do in the middle of the night. Now, the choppers that were downed in the collision in Phoenix were covering a high-speed police chase. And we know why television stations insist on sending choppers out to cover that stuff. Ratings. But the choppers that gathered over the airspace in Santa Monica on Tuesday morning were covering not even anything as newsworthy as a high-speed car chase. They were covering the arrest of Lindsay Lohan because she was taken to Santa Monica Police Department. So why not put choppers over the police department so you can get an aerial view in the darkness of the top of her head? Days after, F is for FEMA, days after FEMA's chief spokesman said concerns about formaldehyde wouldn't stop it from selling or donating surplus disaster trailers, the agency now says it's reviewing the policy. FEMA headquarters has issued an advisory that says the agency is, quote, reviewing a number of policies relating to travel trailers. None of this, of course, would have come out had not a congressional committee spotlit the problem of formaldehyde in FEMA trailers. It's been known in New Orleans for months. But, you know, New Orleans isn't the country, in case that hasn't been made abundantly clear by now. But it's not just New Orleans. It's been 5 months since two tornadoes devastated the town of Dumas in Kansas. Nearly 100 homes were destroyed. Many of those residents are still living in FEMA trailers. A handful of residents in Dumas say their homes could be making them sick. And when I brought up the hearings last week, a listener wrote to say, well, where's the formaldehyde coming from? Is that possibly Chinese wood? Because it's Blame the Chinese Week. And I know I helped fan those flames. But I went and read up on it, and I don't know where the wood's from, but the trailers are made here, right here in the good old U.S. of A. Proud to say that. We're killing our own folks. No foreigners doing it for us. And the problem seems to be, as close as I can tell from the reading that I had time to do while counting my other monies, that the trailers were, when they're manufactured, you know, laminates, cheesy wood laminates that are used in travel trailers as opposed to real hunks of wood, you know, little pieces of wood glued together. See, this is gluing. This is me gluing right now. The glues used in those woods, I'm just going to make everything a plural now, give off fumes, or as it's called in the trade, maybe my favorite new word of the week, outgassing. That's outgassing. And you have to cure the wood. Let the trailer rest and let the wood, the glue, whatever it is, cure so that the outgassing is complete before you ship the trailer to the, and of course my other favorite word, end user. Well, FEMA didn't do that. They were in a hurry because they hadn't stockpiled trailers because they weren't expecting a disaster. It's just FEMA. So they put in a rush order and the trailers hadn't completed their outgassing before being shipped down south. Now, of course, the cure is to ventilate the trailers but they arrive someplace where it's hot and you want to close the windows and turn on the air conditioning. So there you go. Hope I cleared that up for you, or if not, hope I confused you. And now, ladies and gentlemen, news of the warm, won't you? I think you already did.
Soft, listen to the warm.
Man-made global warming has increased rainfall in Britain, according to a new study. This comes just in time to make the Brits feel better about those historic floods they're suffering right now because of the rain. An analysis carried out by an international group of scientists found that increases in greenhouse gas released during the 20th century has increased rain levels. Global warming leads to more rainfall because higher atmospheric pressures increases water vapor. This is the first clear evidence of an overall increase in precipitation levels caused by the thing. The study is published in the journal Nature. In the UK, wetter winters are expected, which will lead to more extreme rainfall. Summers are expected to get drier. However, it is possible, says the author of the paper, that under climate change there could be an increase of extreme rainfall even under general drying. You remember him? He ran the war for a while. Recent events are associated with unusual weather patterns that could be linked to the tropical oceans. And the presence of ozone in the lower levels of the atmosphere, ozone, don't you know, is seriously hampering crop yields and could result in widespread climate change this century. This is new. This is a British report, also in the journal Nature. By 2100, ozone levels will be at an all-time high near the Earth's surface. These levels will themselves spur large-scale global warming. This ozone will deplete plants' ability to absorb carbon dioxide, thus increasing CO2 levels in the atmosphere, in turn increasing the heat trapped in the Earth's atmosphere. Climate models have largely ignored atmospheric chemistry, but in this research we've identified a cause of potentially increased warming, says the lead researcher, Dr. Stephen Sitch. The near-surface ozone has almost doubled from 1950 levels, thanks largely to industrial processes. We've learned so much about ozone in the beginning of the 20th century. I think it's true to say that it was believed that if you went to the seashore, you can enjoy the ozone. There's a street in Venice, California, named Ozone Avenue, in tribute to that little piece of misinformation. And British scientists have determined that Antarctic limpets might not be able to survive global warming. Thank God Don Knotts died before this. Compared with their temperate and tropical cousins, cold-blooded polar marine animals are incapable of fast growth. Until now, scientists assumed a lack of food in winter was the major limiting factor. But according to the author of the study, new studies of the protein-making abilities of limpets in both the sea around the British Antarctic Station and in the laboratory aquarium reveal the animals cannot efficiently make proteins. All right, that's enough about limpets. News of the warm, ladies and gentlemen. Not that I don't care about limpets. Don't get me wrong. I care about limpets. Have I made that clear? Message, I care. News of the digital wonderland. Now, the coming transition from analog to digital television has some in Congress a little worried that consumer confusion may come back to haunt them. Wasn't that predicted? Many's the time on this broadcast. Wait till Congress starts hearing from angry constituents. My TV's off! Congress isn't so excited about the digital transition now, wary of a consumer backlash. In a hearing this week, some expressed concern the government wasn't doing enough to educate the public on the transition. Far too few of these consumers know the transition is underway, says Senator Daniel Inouye. Others referred to it as a, quote, potential for a train wreck, unquote, when it occurs. We have to keep our railroads alive, ladies and gentlemen, just so that metaphor remains relevant. Some lawmakers worry those who feel they weren't informed about the digital takeover could take it out on their elected officials. The digital switch would only truly have the potential to affect the 19% of Americans who still receive programming via antenna. Why, that's only a fifth of the population. That wouldn't affect anything politically. As many as 3 out of every 5 Americans know little or nothing of the pending switchover, according to polls. We know how accurate they are. Quote, the time to act is now before the digital transition devolves into a digital disaster, said Inoue. Congress has allocated $5 million to launch a consumer education program. Some committee members are dissatisfied the FCC has not forced broadcasters to begin to air public service announcements on their air. That would be a good place. And in the quote of the week, Senator Claire McCaskill, Democrat of Missouri, saying she was very discouraged. We don't have more finite answers because February 2009 is like tomorrow if we're talking about government time. She says, quote of the week, it's not hard to educate the United States of America. It's called, you do it over television, unquote. That must be why we're so educated, because of all our TV. We might be overeducated. The broadcasting industry says, quote, broadcasters will do our dead-level best to educate Americans on this transition. Well, I would hope, because they're the next ones to be the target of public anger after it's burned itself out on the politicians. And now, ladies and gentlemen, news from outside the bubble. Just don't be the wrong race or color when there's a terrorist plot that's been uncovered. That's the lesson of this story. Dateline Australia, from The Australian, owned by Rupert Murdoch. So, people who wrote this story received other monies. Mohammed Hanif has been freed from prison after the Australian government revoked his detention order and Commonwealth prosecutors abandoned their terror proceedings against him amid top-level admissions of serious mistakes. After more than 3 weeks in custody, he is not still completely free. Or he was. He was in a state of residential detention, although they have finally let him leave the country. He was released after the Australian Federal Police Commissioner Mick Keelty remained unapologetic about the performance of his agency. Commonwealth Director of Public Prosecutions Damien Bugg admitted his agency had been at fault by putting 2 errors of fact before the court, one that Dr. Hanif's SIM card had been found in a burning car in Glasgow, where that burning car was found. And there was another error of fact introduced as well. These statements were made in the early stages of the investigation. The prosecutor who made the incorrect statements did not have the benefit of a prepared statement of facts. Well, all right then. Yes, it concerned the assertion that a SIM card had been found in a burning vehicle and that Dr. Hanif had resided with, quote, persons of interest in relation to the British attempted bombing. The surest sign that the government screwed up is that Prime Minister John Howard, who faces election this year, distanced himself from the case. He said the moves were up to the head of the police. Prime ministers don't conduct prosecutors, nor do attorneys general. Bugg said he would consider making a formal apology to Dr. Hanif after conducting a full review of the case. And his lawyer, Dr. Hanif's lawyer, called for the immediate reinstatement of his work visa so he can actually continue to work in Australia. Make a living, you know? Anyway, Dr. Hanif has gone off to India to see his newborn baby. More news from outside the bubble. The Times of London, also owned by Rupert Murdoch, says a senior government aide in Britain has sounded out Washington on the possibility of an early British military withdrawal from Iraq. The end of the coalition. Simon MacDonald, the Prime Minister's chief foreign policy advisor, left the impression that he was, quote, doing the groundwork for Prime Minister Brown, according to one of those he consulted. Downing Street remains emphatic that Brown will not unveil a plan to withdraw British troops until the Iraqi army is deemed capable of maintaining security. And the temperature today in hell is about 78 degrees. Here's a goofy one, though, from the Sunday Telegraph, not owned by Rupert Murdoch in Britain. A deep split has emerged within Al-Qaeda, dig this, over the wisdom of the terror network's drive to overthrow and kill Pakistan's president Pervez Musharraf, according to radical Pakistani Islamists. Ayman al-Zawahiri, number two in Al-Qaeda, has ordered the retaliatory attacks on Pakistani targets that have followed the storming of the Red Mosque. But some senior figures within Al-Qaeda are alarmed that the mission to topple and kill General Musharraf will provoke a Pakistani military backlash that could jeopardize their safe havens. Oh, really? Toppling Musharraf would threaten their safe havens. So what does that mean about the continuation of Musharraf in power? And finally, the new reactor in Sydney, Australia, has shut down for 8 weeks because of technical faults, says the Australian Nuclear Science and Technology Organization, or ANSTO. There were no safety or radiation exposure issues, ANSTO said. This follows problems identified since the new reactor began operating 11 months ago. Equipment which has faults will be thoroughly investigated and, where possible, repaired, said the chief executive of ANSTO. And what will be done if it's not possible to repair it? There's a dilution problem earlier this year where light water from a reactor pool seeped into the heavy water contained in the reflector vessel around the core. Further pressure testing is required. If left unrepaired, the dilution would ultimately affect the performance of the reactor. It's not a safety issue. It just affects the performance of the reactor. It's clean, safe, and plentiful. Shut up. ANSTO would also examine fuel plates that were dislodged this week when fuel assemblies were inserted into the core during the fuel change. ANSTO will be undertaking a series of tests to fully determine the cause of that event. Because partially determining it just wouldn't be determining enough. News from outside the bubble, ladies and gentlemen, copyrighted feature of this broadcast. And speaking of things nuclear, Westinghouse signed deals this week to build four nuclear power plants in China and to transfer technology for its newest reactor to its Chinese partner. That's the price of gaining a foothold in the Chinese industry. That's not going to come back to haunt us. New Scientist reports that it's pretty easy to get radioactive material from within this country to build a dirty bomb. Posing as staff from a construction firm, members of the U.S. General Government Accountability Office asked the Nuclear Regulatory Commission for a license to purchase small amounts of substances such as cesium-137. 4 weeks later, without running detailed checks on the company or requesting a visit, the NRC issued the license. The GAO staff then altered the license to indicate they had NRC approval to purchase unlimited amounts of radioactive material. Suppliers of such material accepted faxed copies of the doctored license and even offered discounts for purchasing larger quantities. I'm fine. How are you?
Out in the desert, there's a soldier lying dead. Vultures pecking the eyes out of his head. Another day that could have been me there instead. Nobody loves me here. Nobody loves me here. Dad's gonna kill me. Dad's gonna kill me. You hit the booby trap and you're in pieces. With every bullet your risk increases. Old Alibaba is a different species. Nobody loves me here. Nobody loves me here. Dad's gonna kill me. Dad's gonna kill me. I'm dead meat and my heart beat Frankenstein. I hit the home if I can live through today. Before I came out here, I never used to pray. Nobody loves me here, nobody loves me here. Dad's gonna kill me. Oh, Dad's in a bad mood, Dad's got the blues. It's someone else's mess that I didn't choose. At least we're winning on the Fox Evening News. Nobody loves me here, nobody loves me here. Dad's gonna kill me. Dad's gonna kill me. Don't patrol when I didn't come back. I'm the wire up real like I told you, Mac. But then we shovel him into you, into a sack. Dad's gonna kill me. Dad's gonna kill me. That stranger walking in my dreams. Who's that stranger casting shadow across my heart? Who's that stranger? I dare speak his name. Must be old death a walking. Must be old death a walking. Dad's gonna kill me. Seven muzzle monkeys standing in a row, standing waiting for that sandbox to blow. Sitting targets in the Wild West show. Nobody loves me here, nobody loves me here. Dad's gonna kill me. Dad's gonna kill me.
This is Le Show. The world has changed again this week. Forever. Really. Really forever. Just nothing is ever going to be the same because CNN had a debate where the questions came from YouTube. I swear, if somebody on CNN one more time said historic in connection with that little stunt, I'm going to send them money because they obviously need it. And, of course, just to underline their point, they've rerun that debate more often than a head-on commercial. It's I'm sure whatever time you're hearing this broadcast, you can tune into CNN and they're rerunning that debate because it was so historic, don't you know? They must have paid somebody something to hype it that heavily. Or there are other monies involved. I don't know. But there was some news made on the historic CNN YouTube debate. I hope the historians are writing about it right now, before it goes away. Hillary Clinton and Senator Obama, well, Senator Obama, I think, was asked. Look, I don't know who the question was directed to because it was YouTubed. It probably wasn't direct. I haven't watched it enough, obviously. Would you commit to talking to the leaders of enemy governments, quote, you know, enemies like Syria, Iran, Venezuela, Cuba, in the first year of your term, if you're elected. And Senator Obama said, yeah, I would. And Hillary Clinton issued a statement the next day calling it naive. I think she attacked it on the debate, too, but then expanded on the attack in a statement the next day calling it naive, saying, well, you know, yeah, you can't guarantee this because then they'll what? I don't know. The Obama people then said, then counterattacked or defended themselves, however you look at it. And then the Hillary Clinton people accused Obama of not changing the tone of politics because the Clinton campaign rolls on, however, doing great in the polls. She's got her husband campaigning with her, at least in Iowa, and probably many other parts of the country as she travels. And the other news that Hillary made this week was appearing on the floor of the Senate. No, standing on the floor. Don't get me wrong. In an outfit with a plunging V, not plunging, let's be honest, a V-neckline that, according to the Washington Post's fashion columnist, showed a little bit of cleavage. And the Washington Post fashion columnist, who won a Pulitzer Prize for writing about fashion. Something really is rotten when you can do that. Anyway, she wrote this piece about the meta-analysis of Hillary Clinton now showing cleavage, tiniest bit of cleavage, on the Senate floor. And the Clinton campaign, after a day, responded with a fundraising letter to its supporters saying, this is what we're up against. For more insight on what they're up against, it's another episode of Clinton Something next here on the show.
Clinton Something, the campaign years.
How are you? You know, my husband, Bill.
Hey, glad to see you. Thanks for coming. You know, this is a very important election coming up in a few months. And
thanks again. We've got 500 of these to do. Each one doesn't need a novella.
Hey, hon, if you don't like the squawk, don't bring the rooster.
What's that supposed to mean? Hello? Haven't seen you in ages. You're looking great. You know this guy.
Hey.
See you at the dinner. Now, you did that just to spite me.
What? I said, hey, short and sweet.
So what's this about not bringing the rooster? You're not getting off this gig this early, my friend.
You know something? I'm going to choose to take that as a compliment. But seriously, Hill, I don't know what bayou crap James is filling your head with, but this week proved to me that your operation's got momentum. You're finding your voice. You're on the attack. You got...
Finding my voice. I'm going to choose to take that as a compliment.
You got Obama on the run? What the hell you need to cart around my old bones for?
Well, hello, and thank you for the check. That was amazing. You know, these old bones.
Hey, pretty good weather for a fundraiser, huh? Yeah, we must know somebody. Good to see you.
Because we're still in first gear. It took us a day to jump on Obama about negotiating with our enemies, and it took almost that long to generate the fundraising letter complaining about the story about my cleavage. That's slow motion politics. And I want you around a little while longer because you're the only one my campaign's afraid of. They've seen your temper.
See, I thought the Obama timing was perfect. You waited until CNN's fifth rerun of the debate was half over. That's right in the pocket. But as for the cleavage thing, damn, woman, if you're past 50 and they're still writing about your cleavage, you ought to be taking that as a compliment.
You're nuts. How are you? This is a great event, and you really made it happen. Thank you. And
what do you think? We're looking at the first really hot president, aren't we? Good to see you.
And what was that?
What?
You're trying to prove you're a loose cannon who should be set free to do your 100,000 a pop speeches?
Man, when somebody says I'm looking fine, I got no problem with that, and it doesn't mean they take me any less seriously. Anyway, I'm more than happy to campaign with you every weekend, as long as you think I'm helping. You know, I'm baggage, too. Ask Al Gore.
See, I think somewhere in the Obama thing, somewhere we missed a move. We ended up accusing him of violating his promise to change the political debate because he responded to my attack on him. We're never going to convince people I'm more of a reformer than... Don't you look amazing? Thanks for coming. I know what an effort it was. You know, Bill...
I can't thank you enough. You know where your seats are? You didn't think she might have been told how she looks?
She's just had foot cancer, for God's sake.
All right, my bad. Look, I agree with you. You're selling experience, and that's what your attack started out with. How you ended up being outraged about a politician being political. I agree there had to be a screw loose in that plan somewhere, but these are growing pains, Hill. The advantage of such a long campaign is you got time to get good.
And the disadvantage is you have to get good earlier than ever.
See, once you put him on the defensive about talking to Castro, like that's even possible now, you should have just moved on, gotten back to your brand. But I'm sure somebody on the staff wanted to do that.
Look, don't get me wrong. I love the idea of a staff that gets off on being the most aggressive campaign. I think that's good front-runner strategy. But, Bill, I think my folks need a touch of... your maturity, I keep hoping it'll rub off.
Man, I've actually lived long enough where you're complimenting me and my maturity. That's...
Good evening. So nice to see you both again after the thing. You know, Bill.
How are you? Look, hon, that's not them getting off. That's the strategy you've been following since day one. I.e., she doesn't think like a woman.
Yeah.
The more testosterone this campaign has, the better. What women don't understand is that in politics, and probably in life too, it's always better to be called bitchy than wimpy. Mm-hmm. But look, I'm glad to do this till the cows come home. I just think somewhere along the line, you're going to want to take the training wheels off.
No, I don't see you as training wheels, Bill. I see you as a trusted companion and advisor, as surefire crowd bait, and as a mischief-prone guy traveling in a mischief-free zone. Stick with me, kid. Hello, thank you for the check and the cookies.
Youthful angst and middle-aged quest for power. Together they add up to Clinton something, the campaign years.
My good man will never know. the blues everywhere I see. We're in the blues everywhere I see. We're in the blues, honey, everywhere I see. No one ever had the blues like me. Play your guitar, please.
Ladies and gentlemen, when people say that the neocons are in disarray and are not in favor in Washington anymore, there's this from the Philadelphia Examiner, a group of military experts at the American Enterprise Institute, concerned that the U.S. was on the verge of a calamitous failure in Iraq, almost single-handedly convinced the White House to change its strategy last winter. They banded together at American Enterprise Institute headquarters in Washington early last December and hammered out the plan for the surge during a weekend session. Then came trips to the White House by AEI military historian Fred Kagan, retired Army General John Keane, and other surge proponents. More and more officials began attending the sessions. Even Vice President Dick Cheney came. "We took the results of our planning session immediately to people in the administration," said an AEI analyst. "It became sort of a magnet for movers and shakers in the White House. The AEI approach won out over plans from the Pentagon and U.S. Central Command." Okay. Don't mess with AEI. They got Coors money. Now, the apologies of the week. Or is that Heritage? Heritage has Coors money.
We're so sorry.
I don't know whose money AEI has, but it's other monies. You know that. Deadline Albany Governor Elliot Spitzer indefinitely suspended his communications director and reassigned another top official after his attorney general's office issued a scathing report accusing the governor's staff of using the state police for political purposes. This was a devastating blow to a governor who'd promised to bring a new dawn of ethical responsibility to state politics. "I apologized to Senator Bruno, the Republican leader, and I did so personally this morning," said Governor Spitzer. "In addition, I apologize to the men and women of the state police for allowing this esteemed institution to be drawn into this matter. Finally, I apologize to the people of the state of New York for having allowed this matter to have become a distraction from the vital work at hand." Unquote. Dateline Columbia, South Carolina. South Carolina Treasurer Thomas Ravenel resigned from office this week, more than a month after he was indicted on a federal cocaine charge. Quote, "I'm deeply disappointed in myself," said Ravenel, his voice shaking as he made an apology. "To the people of South Carolina and to my family, I am deeply sorry. Now I believe I must resign." He did not answer questions from reporters and left with his sisters supporting him on each arm. Dateline Kansas City, Royals outfielder Emil Brown hit a television reporter near the eye with a pellet from a small plastic gun in the baseball team's clubhouse this week. A team spokesman said Brown didn't mean to shoot KNBC sports reporter Karen Carnacki with the plastic pellet gun. "It was certainly an accident," said the Royals spokesman. "He wasn't shooting at anybody. I was just messing around in here," Brown said. "I feel terrible about it." Brown said he tried to call Carnacki to apologize, but was unable to reach her. Former District Attorney Mike Nifong apologized this week to the three former Duke lacrosse players he had tried to prosecute on sexual assault charges and to their families. Speaking at a hearing on criminal contempt charges against him, Nifong said after reading the State Attorney General's full report on the case, he no longer believes there was credible evidence to proceed with cases against the players. "Now just apologize, all of us television viewers, for wasting our time." Even before Kelly Clarkson released her new album, the former American Idol star had been doing a lot of talking. She promoted her new album as her own creation and slammed her producer, music legend Clive Davis, over his attempt to commercialize the album. Now Kelly Clarkson's apology has become public knowledge as well. She decided to apologize Clive Davis and did so publicly via her official website. "I want to set the record straight," she said. Where's the apology? "I really regret how this has turned out, and I apologize to those to whom I have done a disservice," she wrote on her website. "I would never intentionally hurt anyone." The most surreal day in the 104-year history of the Tour de France began with an anti-doping protest, continued with the mountaintop arrest of a rider who admitted using banned testosterone, and concluded with the overall leader being ejected from the race by his own team, Denmark's Michael Rasmussen. Tour director Christian Prudhomme apologized for having hurt us, and he also... What? Is that right? No, it's a different Christian. The story is all screwed up. A New York accountant got a bit too much of a good thing when ExxonMobil sent him 2,000 credit cards on top of the two he'd requested. Frank Van Buren told the New York Daily News that shredding the first box of 1,000 cards took 3 hours. He wasn't pleased when ExxonMobil sent him a second box a few days later and refused to take them back and do the shredding, instead offering him $25 for his time. Citibank has apologized for any inconvenience caused by the mix-up and said it appreciated Van Buren's efforts to prevent anyone from misusing the surplus cards. Almost through with the apologies of the week, ladies and gentlemen. However, this one we must take time for from the When Good Newscasts Go Bad department. Here's Keith Olbermann.
One additional political note. We owe an apology for something that happened on this newscast on a night I was off last weekend. We offer it fully and unreservedly. It is to Mrs. Wendy Vitter, wife of the senator from Louisiana who's been caught up in the D.C. mask scandal. And last Tuesday, this newscast aired a segment about her attire and her demeanor at their joint news conference. Not only was a series of unfortunate and inappropriate terms used, there was no justification for such a segment devoted to analysis of what a woman, a victim of her husband's inappropriate behavior, was wearing in public. The story should not have aired, it should not have been couched in the terms used, it should not have happened, and it won't happen again. So to Mrs. Vitter and to you, the viewer, I once again apologize.
A copyrighted feature of this broadcast. Sweet it is. Just before we go, the San Diego desk passes on a strange business solicitation. The U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service is looking for somebody to build SCIF meeting space, converting a room at the Fish and Wildlife Facility in Shepherdstown, West Virginia. What's SCIF? Secure Compartmented Information Facility, approved by NSA. Just the sort of thing any Fish and Wildlife Service needs. Yes, it's traveling music. That's going to conclude this edition of the show. The program returns next week at the same time over these same stations over NPR worldwide throughout Europe, the USN 440 cable system in Japan, around the world through the facilities of the American Forces Network up and down the east coast of North America via the shortwave giant WBCQ, The Planet, on Mighty 104 in Berlin, on Sirius and XM satellite radios. May they never merge. Around the world via the internet at two different locations, live and archive whenever you want it on your computer, harryshearer.com, kcrw.com, available as a free download at www.audible.com/the show, and available as a free podcast at kcrw.com. And it'd be just like me appearing on Late Night with Conan O'Brien this Tuesday evening, if you'd agree to be with me next week, would you? All righty, thank you very much. A tip of the Le Show chapeau to the San Diego and Pittsburgh and Chicago desks, playlists, and an email portal are available for you at the new harryshearer.com, where you'll also see word of the big news to come this week. I can say no more, but it does not involve other monies. The show comes to you from Century of Progress Productions and originates through the facilities of KCRW Santa Monica, a community recognized around the world as the home of the homeless.